13. Romans 13. Let every person be subject to the governing authorities. For there is no authority except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God. Therefore, whoever resists the authorities resists what God has appointed, and those who resist will incur judgment. For rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. Would you have no fear of the one who is in authority? Then do what is good, and you will receive his approval. For he is God's servant for your good. But if you do wrong, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword in vain. For he is the servant of God, an avenger, who carries out God's wrath on the wrongdoer. Therefore, one must be in subjection, not only to avoid God's wrath, but also for the sake of conscience. For because of this, you also pay taxes, for the authorities are ministers of God attending to this very thing. Pay to all what is owed to them, taxes to whom taxes are owed, revenue to whom revenue is owed, respect to whom respect is owed, and honor to whom honor is owed. You know, for a couple thousand years, or a good 1,500 of it, nobody had any real problems with this passage. In fact, I suspect that to many kings and rulers throughout the Middle Ages and all the way into the 1700s, 1800s, required of their pastors, priests, and clergy to preach on this on a regular basis. In fact, this passage was used in countless situations to sort of subdue the people and remind them that the king had some divine right, authority to do whatever he wanted. But then came the 20th century. And in the 20th century, with World War I and World War II, and maybe more importantly, the rise of communism in Russia after a revolution, and the spread of communism, and then totalitarian dictators jumping up all over the world like Idi Amin, or even to this day, Kim Jong-un, that's how you say his name, right? Kim Jong-un? I always confuse him with his dad. We get these totalitarian leaders that, ooh, man, are we going to submit to that? Is God saying you submit to that kind of, is that really a government that praises the good and suppresses the evil? That if you are a righteous and a good person, you have nothing to fear under these kinds of rulers. And this passage went under attack. In fact, so much so that there was a time, I think in the 70s, 60s and 70s, and maybe early 80s, where if you went to certain seminaries, you can do anything you want with this passage, but if you agree with it, there's something wrong with you. There's something wrong with you. It cannot possibly be correct. This is one of the examples of Paul, you know, speaking from his own perspective, and he just didn't understand what God was doing in the gospel, if you can imagine that. I can imagine it. I see it all the time. I see all the time people thinking they know more than God, his word, and his servants. I was watching the news yesterday, and one of the leading news guys, they were talking about a particular situation that's irrelevant, but they got into marriage, and he made the classic statement that I hear from so many people that I counsel with, or people that just live in our world. Look at you, wouldn't buy a new Mercedes without driving it first, would you? Why in the world would you ever marry somebody without living with them first? Now, this is one of the lead guys on the news. And then he even said, now I know it sounds like that I'm suggesting that you sin. No, it doesn't sound that way. It is that way. But that's not your problem. That's not your problem. What it sounds like and what it is that you think you know more about how a car works than Ford, or how a marriage works than God. That's what it really sounds like to me. It sounds like you think you actually know more about what will make a marriage work right than the one who designed it and created it. Because what you're saying is, logic tells me this is true. The Bible just got this wrong. God just got this wrong. Well, as soon as he said it, I just thought, really? How's that worked out for you? How's it worked out for you trying it out? We have so less, much less divorce in our country because we started trying it out, right? No. Our divorce rates have just exploded. And you know what? Even, and this is what's amazing about people, human beings, doesn't matter what country, they are blind to their foolishness. When they think they know more than God knows, God can, okay, we'll go with it. We'll go your way. Let's see how that works out. And it is disaster. But do you think that they can look back and say, wow, this experiment of living with each other before we get married really has improved marriage, really has given a stability for our children, really has taken all kinds of social issues out of play. No longer do we have people living in anguishing relationships where the only way out is to kill themselves. Wait a minute, I'm just describing what we have. You see how, and the thing that amazes me is, even with all of that evidence out there, we've now got 30, 40 years of it, we still sit there on our nightly news and say, no one would buy a Mercedes without trying it out. Well, let me tell you something about that analogy. If Mercedes said, look it, we're not going to put any transmission fluid in this car until you put your name on the dotted line. Let's see how many of you guys are going to try out that car before you buy it. Now, guys, that's a great analogy. Because God is saying, listen, I'm not going to pour my spirit into this if you're going to ignore me and just do it your way. And that's what we're getting. See, we're buying Mercedes with no transmission fluids, or we're not buying it. We're going to take it out and test run it. Well, you know what? If you test run it for very long, you won't get it back to the place where you can purchase it. Now, what does this have to do with this passage? Well, guys, this is another one of these passages. Are we going to trust God? Or are we going to trust what makes so much sense to us? If this could possibly be right. Well, yes, it can possibly be right. And in fact, I think God has let us do it our way numerous times. And we have seen the outcome of it. And we'll come back to an analogy of that. But before we look at the text itself, I want to give some historical background. Two things that are just general things in the history of the ancient world that we need to know to appreciate what Paul's saying here. And two things that are specifically related to what Paul is saying here in the context of Jewish history. So just general history. As we read this passage, we tend to think that the Bible is giving way too much credit to rulers. That the Bible and God and Paul are giving these guys way more credit than anyone should ever give them. We should be much more suspect of any ruler. That's how we typically read this. And if you were honest with me, you probably would read this and go, oh, yeah, I can see that. Let's remember something about the ancient world. Romans 13 has severely demoted the king and the emperor. This passage and Christianity and Paul has severely demoted the ruler. Why can I say that? Because the ruler thinks he's God. In the ancient world, guys, kings and emperors claimed to be deities. Paul says, you're not a deity. You're a servant. And don't forget it. Because there's things that go along with that. See, the modern person reads this passage and thinks, boy, the Bible has this archaic view of uplifting rulers and leaders and putting them on such pedestals and creating such programs and possibilities for them to do such harm in the world. You need to read the chapter in light of the context he's writing to. He just called Caesar, who thinks he's God and can do anything, you are a servant of the Lord. You're a servant of God. Don't forget it. And all that comes with that, as we think about people who are servants of God, as we think about the teachings of Jesus, as we think about the teachings of the Old Testament, remember, servants are held accountable. Remember? Think of all the parables. What about the parable where Jesus, or this person, this king, it says, he goes away and he leaves a servant in charge of caring for his people. And that servant abuses them. And what will happen to him when the king comes back? What will happen to him when Jesus comes back? Well, you see, all of those parables now apply to our rulers. They're not just applied to Christians or people in ancient times. They're applied to our rulers. All authority and power has been given to who? Jesus. When he was raised from the dead, all authority and power and kingdoms are given to him. He is the rightful authority over all kingdoms. Consequently, any ruler of any kingdom is a servant of Jesus. Jesus has expectations. And if you don't meet those expectations, he's made it abundantly clear. You will answer to him. You will probably answer to him in this life. You probably won't have to wait for the final judgment, though you will answer to him there as well. So there's certain things I want to paint on the canvas before we paint the picture. The background is this. Paul just did something very bold. He just called an emperor who thinks he's God a servant and a minister, and that he has been given a task. Nero has been given a task by a far superior, far, 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 far superior authority. And that task is this: praise the good. Praise the good behavior in your people. And punish the wrong. Punish the wrong. That's your job, Nero. Now do it and do it right, because you will answer. So that's one thing that we need to keep in context. There's another thing. Sometimes I think we misread Romans 13 because we don't appreciate government enough. And I think the ancient world would have appreciated it more, even bad government. And here's why. In the ancient world, they were far closer to anarchy than they ever were to Big Brother. You see, in the modern world, we're far closer to Big Brother. And by that, I mean a government that is everywhere, omniscient, always putting their hands in, overruling, over. We are closer to that than we are to anarchy. That is not the case in the ancient world. Even in the Roman world, you think Rome was this huge military enterprise and the government. It was the most government the world had ever seen. But if you were an ancient historian, you would realize that even in the Roman Empire, if you went to these cities in these far-off provinces, man, they were this far from total anarchy. And let me tell you something. The people of the ancient world knew the difference between anarchy and a bad ruler. And they would take a bad ruler every day. Because anarchy is a nation full of bad rulers. Remember that. Anarchy is a nation full of bad rulers. A totalitarian, evil, wicked ruler, he's just one guy. He can only do so much damage. If you have no government at all, then people live by their own rules and principles and standards and what they want to do, and you have just multiplied evil, the evil of one, by however many people are in your nation state. So just a second principle to keep in mind. In the ancient world, they are far closer to anarchy than they are to too much government. Consequently, when Paul speaks these words, I think they would have been more appreciated. They had an understanding that government was actually a gift from God. They had an understanding, you know, sometimes the emperor thought he was the gift from God or that he was God himself. But government itself is a gift from God that greatly reduces the sinful impulses, the violent impulses of the people that it governs. And it enables people to live in a far more peaceable way with one another and with their neighbors. It also created security for them from outside enemies that wanted to destroy them. So those two things. Now there's two more specific historical things that you need to know as you read this passage. Number one is, Romans was written in about 59 AD, some say 60, somewhere right in there, early Nero reign. Well, in 50, that's in the same decade, guys, Claudius threw out all of the Jews from Rome because of a riot that was caused by a person, quote, named Crestus, which almost all historians realize now they're talking about Christ. And it wasn't caused by Christ, it was caused over Christ. And the problem was the Jews divided into two groups and it became violent. Now, we just presume that the violence was that the Jews that rejected Jesus became violent towards the Jews that embraced him. That is certainly possible, though we don't know that. There could have been some violence on both parts, but whatever it was, Claudius said, enough's enough, you're all out. Kicked them all out. So this is in the very recent past of this church. Consequently, as Paul writes these words, I think he's thinking, guys, how do we handle this? We didn't handle it very well the last time or something. We've got to figure out a way to respond to our opponents, to respond to the people that are violently angry with us, or to respond to a government. We've got to show Rome that we are good citizens, that we are not a threat to them, that we're not a danger to them, that we are not espousing armed rebellion and rising up and overthrowing the Senate and overthrowing Caesar. So that's partly in Paul's mind because they've had this issue. He's got another thing he has to think about. In Palestine, that very issue is becoming a groundswell. Amongst his Jewish compatriots and their various sects, many of them are starting to move towards the only solution to the Roman problem is the sword. And we need to rise up and revolt. And of course, if you know your history, less than a decade from this letter, it began in 68 AD. An armed revolt from Jewish people claiming they have to overthrow Rome in this way, which led to the destruction of Jerusalem, the destruction of the temple, and 1 million Jews being killed. And just in case you thought they learned their lesson, 50 years later, in 130 BC, a guy named Bar Kokhba rose up, said, I'm the Messiah, convinced the Jews once again to take up sword and revolt against the government, the Roman government over them. And once again, 1 million Jews lost their lives. And they were scattered even further. Now, my point is here that Paul, I think, can see some of this coming. And he wants Christian Jews in particular to know that's not how we do things. Because that's not how Jesus did it. Guys, that was the very reason why they rejected Jesus. They wanted Jesus to come, take up the sword, and defeat their enemies. Jesus, now here's another point we'll come back to at the very end. Don't think for a minute that Jesus is not interested in defeating Rome. He is. He's interested in defeating Israel's enemies. He absolutely is. It's how he's going to do it. That's where the difference is. Jesus, this is how you guys, this is how we're going to overthrow Rome. The next time a Roman soldier tells you to carry his baggage, by Roman law, he can ask anyone to carry it for a mile. I want you to carry it for 2 miles. What? Yeah, that's what I'm saying. This is how we're going to overthrow Rome. You carry his baggage for 2 miles the next time he asks you to carry it for one. Because he can only legally make you do it for one. So if you carry it for one, he looks at you and says, you're doing because you have to do it. But if you carry it the next mile, he has no explanation of why you're carrying his gear. Oh, you know, by the way, if somebody comes and takes your cloak, give him your coat also. If your enemy comes and does this, takes this, give this to him also. You see, the reason why Jesus was rejected wasn't just that he wouldn't take up the sword. He had a totally different way of bringing about a revolution. And his way of bringing about a revolution is lay down your life for your enemy. Love your enemy. Shock your enemy with love. Surprise him with service. Because the only way you can truly overthrow an oppressive government is to turn them into your friends. is to turn their hearts and leave it to God to judge them if they are unwilling to turn. Okay, so that's the second. Those are the historical things, the Claudius and the situation with the Jews that happens in 70 AD, ultimately where the destruction of Jerusalem takes place. Okay, now let's come into the passage a little bit. And let's see what we can learn from this passage. Let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God. I've often wondered in some of those liberal seminaries where they dismiss Paul's teaching on this, are you dismissing Jesus's as well? Because does not Jesus teach the same thing? Does anybody remember Jesus saying something very similar to what Paul says here? Basically, Paul is saying that the authority that the ruler has is an authority that has been given to him by God. Does Jesus ever say that? Okay, he says, we'll come back to that one because that relates directly to the taxes. Does Jesus not say somewhere that the authority you have has been given to you by God above? And who is he talking to? Interesting. I thought we'd have all known that. Pilate. John 19:11. This isn't Paul's teaching. Paul's just regurgitating what Jesus has already said. John 19:11 says, do you not know that I have authority? This is actually Pilate speaking. So Pilate said to him, you will not speak to me? Jesus was being quiet. And Pilate, you are not going to speak to me? Do you not know that I have authority to release you and authority to crucify you? And Jesus answered him. It's the first thing Jesus says to Pilate. You would have no authority over me unless it had been given you from above. Right? You would have no authority over me unless it had been given to you from above. That's what Paul is saying in Romans 13. We'll come back to John 19 in a little bit, but flip back to Romans 13. So the first thing you need to see is all governing authorities, their authority comes from God. Now, there's a new circumstance in the world that we need to be reminded of this particular principle. Up until this point, I don't think anyone would have had any issue. They would say, God, we sure hope that authority doesn't rest with Herod. We sure hope that authority doesn't rest with Nebuchadnezzar or Nero or some other. I think everybody would have been glad to hear, no, the authority, the king, the Caesar, the governing authorities have, it comes from something above them. And the reason why they'd be glad to hear that is because that means there's something above them that could hold them accountable. But something's changed in our world, and now this passage becomes a little more offensive. Because in our country, where does the authority lie? You see, it doesn't lie in the president. It doesn't lie in the Supreme Court. It lies in us. So for the first time in a democracy, you see, we're not acknowledging, oh, I'm sure glad there's an authority above our president and above the Supreme Court. Because in our country, we have made it so. We made sure there would be an authority above them, and that is us, the people. We, the people, are the authority above them. Well, I'm sorry to tell you, no, you're not. No, we're not. Because even in a democracy, God has not surrendered his authority. That God is the authority above any authority we might create. So I'm not saying there's no authority in the people. There is. But the people then will answer to God, like Herod has to. There's a scary thing about a democracy, guys, and this is a great point to just step aside and make some application. We think democracy is a great thing, but you realize that with a democracy and the authority being put in the people's hands, then we then will be held responsible for the things our nation does. Just as Herod will be held responsible, just as Nero is going to be held responsible, just as Nebuchadnezzar is going to be held responsible, the people of America will be held responsible. Why? Because we're the highest authority in this land, and God's authority is above us, and he will require us to answer as the highest authority in the land for what we've done. That's one of the problems with a democracy. There's nobody to scapegoat. There's nobody you can blame for the wrong things a nation does in a democracy, because we are all responsible for it as the ultimate authority. Let's step back to the text. For there is no authority except from God. And for the most part, I think in an ancient world, they would be rejoicing that, wow, at least there's a God up there holding these guys accountable. And those that exist have been instituted by God. God is the one that's created this system to govern sinful people. Therefore, whoever resists the authorities resists what God has appointed, and those who resist will incur judgment. Well, the first thing we want to think of is, in every situation, isn't there some place where we should resist authorities, right? He says here, if you resist authorities, you are resisting God and you will incur judgment. Now, I do think that there's some generalizations here. This may be a good time to turn back to Acts chapter 4 and remember that there are some places in which we resist the authorities above over us. John chapter 4, verse 18. So they called them, that being the authorities, the Sanhedrin, and the rulers, and the chief priests. So they called them and charged them not to speak or teach at all in the name of Jesus. But Peter and John answered them, whether it is right in the sight of God to listen to you rather than to God, you must judge, for we cannot but speak of what we have seen and heard. And I might add here for Peter, for a little punch, and have been commanded to do so. Because Jesus directly commanded them, go into the world and preach, teach, share the gospel, make disciples, baptizing them in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. They have a direct command. Now they have a direct command not to do it. Well, Acts makes it very clear. Guys, when those two commands are directly contrary to one another, which one do you obey? See, this is, Paul isn't giving an explanation of every situation. When he says, do not resist these authorities, because when you resist the authorities, you're resisting God. He's not giving every situation, and here's why. What if you have two different authorities? What if your teacher tells you to do something that your sheriff tells you not to do? Which one do you go with? Why? You go with the sheriff. Why do you go with the sheriff? Because he is a what? Higher authority than your teacher. Okay, well, guess what? When your king tells you to do something that God has told you not to do, which one do you go with? You go with the higher authority. Paul isn't addressing that issue. He knows that's true. He knows that, guys, there are some exceptions here. He's not getting into that. What he's getting into is God is the one who establishes the authority. Did he establish the authority of the teacher? Sure he did. Should students listen to their teacher? Absolutely they should, because they should not resist that authority. Unless what? Unless that teacher is telling them to do something that a higher authority is telling them not to do. And by the way, as a parent, I think I'm a higher authority than my kid's teacher. I wouldn't have had to go to sheriff, but I knew we would have all agreed on the sheriff. But as a parent, I have a higher authority in my child's life than the teacher does. That's a given. I think that's a given. Paul isn't addressing any of that. So let's just set that aside and know that this passage isn't really talking about that. It's talking about when an authority over us asks us to do something, requires something of us, and it does not violate a higher or greater authority, what should our response be? You should subject yourself to that authority. You should submit to that request. Do not resist it, because if you do, you are resisting God. And then he goes on, for rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. Would you have no fear for the one who is in authority? Then do what is good, and you will receive his approval. I wonder if Paul would have said that with his head on the chopping block. Paul was beheaded by this Caesar, Nero. He was beheaded by him. Was he beheaded for doing evil? Or was he beheaded for doing good? I think good. I think we can emphatically say Paul was beheaded for doing good. So Paul, how can you say this? Well, let's go back to John 19. Because I think a question arises. If Paul is right there, then why was Jesus crucified? And why was Paul beheaded? Now, I would once again say, I think Paul is speaking generally. He's not saying that this is always the case, but it is usually the case. But let me suggest that even the crucifixion of Jesus and the beheading of Paul is not the exceptions. What does Jesus actually say here in 19:11 to Pilate? Jesus answered him, "You would have no authority over me at all unless it has been given you from above." So the first thing he says is, Pilate, the authority that you have to crucify me is coming from God. And the authority you have to either praise my goodness or punish me for wickedness, that's coming from God. What's the next line? Therefore, he who delivered me over to you has the greater sin. Now, consequently, Jesus isn't letting Pilate completely off the hook. But he's basically saying, the issue here is not a problem with authority. The problem is not with the authority. The problem is not with Pilate and the governor. Where's the problem? The problem is with these people out here who are lying to the authority. The authority was established to punish wrongdoing. And now there is a crowd of people out here accusing Jesus of wrongdoing. There are multiple witnesses that are claiming he's done something wrong and worthy of death. And as much as Pilate tries to see through it and recognizes this is nonsense or whatever, in the end, the will of the people overrode Pilate. The problem was not with the authority that Jesus was crucified. The problem was with the sinfulness of the people and the will of the people. They are the ones that demanded it. And I would suspect that Paul would say something similar. If somebody would have said, Paul's that guy with the, you know, he's taking the sword back, he's about to take off Paul's head, and somebody came and stepped in, a good 20th century theologian, can I have a question first? Paul, are you still going to hold on to what you said there in Romans 13? Because it looks to me like you're about to die at the hands of your emperor for good. I think Paul would turn to that guy and say, you bet I'm going to. Because the problem was not Nero. The problem was with theologians like you. The problem was with theologians like you who lied about me and accused me wrongly. And they will answer for what they have done. But the problem was not that God made a judge, that God gave authority to a king and to a ruler to exercise law. That's not where the problem is. The problem is you took advantage of the law and abused it and lied about it and deceived to accomplish your purposes through it. The problem wasn't the law. So as we come back to Romans chapter 13, got just one more thing I really want to hit on. But Romans chapter 13, one of its objections, I don't know how big of it, I do think that there are emperors and kings that can do horrible things to good people and are intending to do horrible things to good people. But generally speaking, even a person like Nero, his first instinct is not to kill good people. It's to kill people who he feels threatened by or opposed by, who want to revolt or rebel against him. And then we come to this next, that is not Romans 13, this next line that Paul uses, which I think has got some great application for us today, and we really need to wrestle with it. Because honestly, I think we violate it constantly. We violate it constantly. So as he goes on here, he says, then do what is good and you will receive his approval, for he is God's servant for your good. But if you do wrong, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword in vain, for he is the servant of God, an avenger who carries out God's wrath and on the wrongdoer. Therefore, one must be in subjection, not only to avoid God's wrath, but also for the sake of conscience. Paul seems to say, look it, do not resist your authorities. You are to treat them. In fact, if you jump down to the end here, what are we to give them? To those you owe taxes, pay them taxes. Revenue to whom revenue is owed. Respect to whom respect is owed. And honor to whom honor is owed. And the implication here is our rulers are owed honor and respect. Okay, are we doing that? Let's look at a little event in Paul's life. Acts chapter 23. A little event in Paul's life that could really challenge us. I think it's really challenged me on how do we show respect and honor to our leaders. Paul has been arrested again by this same Sanhedrin that was giving Peter and John some problems. And he was brought before the council. And in fact, he uses the word conscience. And looking intently at the council, Paul said, "Brothers, I have lived my life before God in all good conscience up to this day." So he basically says, I am not here because I've done something wrong. I am here because I've done something right. And the high priest Ananias commanded those who stood by him to strike him on the mouth. Then Paul said to him, God is going to strike you, you whitewashed wall. Are you sitting to judge me according to the law? And yet, contrary to the law, you ordered me to be struck. Those who stood by said, would you revile God's high priest? And Paul said, oh, I didn't know, brothers, that he was the high priest. For it is written, you shall not speak evil of a ruler of your people. What? Paul backed off. Paul apologized. Now the key is, what did he apologize for? And that's hard. Is he apologizing for everything that he said and did there? Or is he apologizing for something specific? But it's important for us to try to figure out what he apologized for. Because Paul is saying, you do not speak of your ruler this way. Well, I'm going to tell you what I think he wasn't apologizing for. I don't think he was apologizing for telling the people that he was of good conscience and had done the right thing. And that he was being brought and being charged falsely. That he was being accused and that they wanted to punish him. And that they were wrong to want to do so because they should be praising him, being the leaders of God's people, for doing good. I don't think he's apologizing for that. I also do not think he's apologizing for reminding them that in the process of charging him, in the process of bringing this case against them, they acted contrary to the law of God. In other words, they are claiming that Paul is breaking the law. But in the very process of charging him of breaking the law, what did they do? They broke the law. Now, you may not know it. I may not know it, but Paul knew it. When the high priest ordered him struck in the face, that's against the law. That's against God's law. That you are not to treat someone being charged in this way until they have been convicted. So Paul is merely reminding his accusers who are claiming that he's violated the law. Guys, you can't do that. You're violating. He's pointing out their injustice in how they're trying him. The same thing could be done and was done in some ways with Jesus. He pointed out the things that they were doing contrary to the law in the trials. You were doing this in an unjust way. I don't think Paul's apologizing for that. So what's left? Just his name calling. It's the only thing that's left here. You whitewashed sepulcher. Now, are they whitewashed sepulchers? Yeah, they are. Jesus called them that. But guess what? Jesus is their judge. Paul is not. I think what Paul is saying is, I really shouldn't have called them that. And I think he went against his own teaching. God is going to strike you. Doesn't that sound like a curse to you? God is going to strike you like you struck me. Sounds like a curse. What did Paul instruct us to do as at least individuals? Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who persecute you. See, Paul's not perfect. Paul got caught up in this moment and he did some things wrong. And he called a curse upon the high priest. And he called him a name. And then when it was pointed out, hey, he's the high priest, Paul said, oh, I was wrong. I was wrong to do this. He's probably wrong to do it with anybody, but he was certainly wrong to do it with the high priest because he's the leader of the people. Is there anything we can learn from this, guys? Anything we can learn? Or was that just for then? That doesn't apply today. Guys, there is nothing wrong with standing out and pointing out injustices. There's nothing wrong with standing out and pointing out, wait a minute, that's not true. There's nothing wrong in pointing out, hey, you're not acting in accordance to the law. There's nothing wrong in saying, look at, you should not treat me this way when, for acting righteously. But there is something wrong when we start calling our leaders names. Even if they're true, because honestly, guys, is not Ananias a whitewashed sepulcher? Is not that name true? The man paints himself as being righteous, and he's the embodiment of unrighteousness. The name is absolutely true. Too bad. Doesn't matter if it's true. Do not speak evil of your rulers. I suspect I'm the most convicted person in this room right now because it just reminds me, you can't speak of your rulers in these kind of negative, derogatory ways. And in fact, why do we think that that's how they speak of each other? Why do you think we have a Senate and a House where they're speaking of each other with no honor, no respect, totally in derogatory ways? You know who we have to blame for that? The highest authority in the land under God. We have us to blame for it because we've been doing it for years. And now they've been doing it for the last couple decades maybe, but we've been doing it for years. And Paul comes along and says, guys, your leaders, you owe them respect. You owe them honor. And if they are ever going to show honor and respect to one another, I fear it will not happen until the people of this country start showing them honor and respect. That does not mean we do not call people out an injustice, but it does mean we just don't fling derogatory names. You know, there is a difference between saying you lied and you are a liar. There is a difference between saying that is a decision that doesn't make a lot of sense to me and you are a moron. We know the difference, don't we? This isn't as hard as I thought it was. I thought it would be hard to distinguish, but it isn't that hard, is it? We know when we step over the line and are not showing honor. And Paul says, no place for that. There's one thing you need to know, two things you probably need to know as we leave, which we didn't get the chance. I want you to go back and read Romans 12, the last five verses, and why. What's the context leading into this? I think Paul's point is, guys, vengeance is the Lord's. You are not to act with personal vengeance. And when you leave vengeance to God, this is how God handles it. You turn it over to your governing authorities and let them deal with the problem. That's why Romans 13 is there. But the last thing is something where I have to now step back after all of that reverence and honor and say, hey, man, we have to have a certain attitude towards our governing authorities. We also can never forget this. The gospel is about regime change. It's about revolution. It's about turning the world upside down and its leaders and its culture. The issue for Paul here is not Christians should never be revolutionary. The very message we preach is revolutionary. Paul is not saying we should be satisfied with the status quo of governments that we have right now. No, we should not be. We should be crying, Maranatha, come, Lord Jesus, come quickly, because we are looking for a far greater government and kingdom. And we cannot forget that the ultimate purpose of what we do as a church is to actually bring down all the world's governments and bring about a regime change by Jesus Christ coming and establishing his kingdom. That's not the issue. The issue is, how do you do it? And Paul says, we do not do this with violence. We do not do this with a sword. We do this by reflecting the love of Christ for his enemies. We do this by turning the world upside down and how we live out our faith like Jesus. But ultimately, our goal is to bring in a new kingdom with a new king who is always going to act righteously. Let's pray.